Judiciary Committee, please come to order. First, we have Senate Bill 154. We have a proposed committee substitute. We've had one hearing on this legislation before. The discussion is liability. Senator Rudy.
Mr. President, I believe everyone knows what we intended to do in terms of correcting an error that was included earlier in this bill package, unknown to all of us. The word draft is a far more straightforward statement of what we intend to do. There is a technical amendment that basically that deals with the proposed committee substitute that every member should have in his or her packet, and it relates just to bank holding company and subsidiary bank holding company language, and is definitional. And I would recommend that the committee also was by our legal counsel, and it is wholly technical.
Okay, so you
there are other people here to testify. I won't take any more time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, why don't we have, let's see, in the order signed up, we have Mary Irvine.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Mary Irvine, and I'm a volunteer with the Alaska Environmental Lobby, which is a coalition of 19 environmental groups from around the state. We've been following this bill for a long time, and in fact, one of the volunteers who worked on this bill, which you may remember or not, her name is Krista Masiolik, is now on the Iditarod Trail. So we've been following this a long time, and as I told Tim in Senator Rohde's office yesterday morning, we're a lot more pleased with this bill than either of the previous versions that we've seen. The first original one defined lending institutions too broadly for our tastes. The second version allowed banks too much ability to manage and escape liability for our case. And this one is a heck of a lot better than those two. I have one question and three comments from the lobby. First, my question is, I'm not sure whether included in the definition of financial institution are state agencies such as ADA, Department of Transportation, AHFC, or the university, those kind of state agencies. From my reading of the bill, it doesn't seem as though they would be included, but I haven't been able to get a straight answer from staff or legislative council. So I'll pose that to you folks.
Which section of the bill you're referring to specifically?
Well, maybe on page one, under, say, on line seven, financial institution means a bank, and whatever the amendment is, I don't have it in front of me, credit institution or savings association. But then down below on line 10, it says insured by FDIC, by another agency of the United States, or by an agency of the state. And we were wondering whether that would include actual agencies of the state, not just lending institutions or financial institutions that would be insured or backed up by agencies of the state.
The answer is no. If you will, the operative language is on line 10 where it says insured in whole or in part. And it just relates to FDIC at all, anybody that is insured by a federal or, and there are no state insurers. So it would be almost wholly FDIC. There might be some other federal insurer, I suppose Reliance Trust now possibly, but that would be it.
Well, great. We're glad to hear that, and thank you for clearing that up.
Senator Frank?
On that, what about credit unions?
Aren't yes, they, on line 10, that they are included, page 1.
Oh,
they were included in that definition.
Right. I don't think the lobby has a problem with that. I'll go on to the three comments that I have, and I'll try to keep them brief, briefer than last time anyway. The first comment that we have is the CS I have in front of me is the third version. I just picked up this amendment, and so I'll be going on the third version. says in the second, or it says in the right-hand corner, 227.92. On page 2, lines 19 through 20, where we're defining what a bank or a lending institution, what kind of participating in the management they can do. On line 19, it says a lending institution, participating in the management of a vessel or facility does not include, and on page 19, the mere capacity or ability to influence. We don't have a problem with that, but we have a problem with the next phrase, or the unexercised right to control facility operations. To our reading of the bill, it looks like banks could have a duty to, not just a right, because with every right comes a responsibility, a duty to act in regards to the facility operations. And this certain phrase, or the unexercised right to control, could absolve banks from omissions with respect to any kind of existing duty that they might have. So the lobby would urge this committee to just delete that phrase, or the unexercised right to control facility operations, and just go with participating in the management of the vessel or facility does not include the mere capacity or ability to influence facility operations.
If I could respond quickly, I believe that that's environmental conservation's language, and every financial entity has the ability through its deeds of trust and other documents to exercise control if they wish, by virtue of the fact that they've lent money, and with a few exceptions, those rights are ones they presumably never want to use. And what is referred to there is basically the options that any third party financer has to impact under certain conditions, and it's part of commercial financing. I don't know, you could delete it, and how much impact it would have, I don't know. But as I say, it met with the, in fact, is the, I believe, and I'll have to check, but the draft we have here was suggested by DEC, and is product of their work on the problem with myself. And I don't know, you know, how taking that out would really do anything, because it reflects reality as it exists in the commercial world, and there always is the unexercised rights, and again, hopefully nobody wants to use them.
Mr. Chairman, I still think that the second phrase is a lot broader than the first. I understand that a bank can have a mere capacity to control a borrower's actions and not exercise them. But when a bank has the right to get in there and control managerial decisions, that's when it starts running up against the day-to-day managerial operations of the facility. And so we'd still have a problem with that language, I think.
I just responded that that's taking, the day-to-day is taken care of in prior sections, and they can't do day-to-day decision making. And also, what you don't want to do is encourage or require a financial institution to be getting involved in the day-to-day operations, because they are not as expert, particularly if you're talking about something that that could have environmental ramifications. You want people that are skilled in that particular area, not just someone who has a financial or fiduciary interest. So I think it's counterproductive to have the financial institution push them into the management, even though they may not be knowledgeable of that particular issue. You're going to want those decisions in the hands of people that are that are skilled, say it's aviation fuel at the airport, people that are skilled in that area and know how to deal with the problem. And that's that I believe is why, and DEC can testify to the issue later on, but I suspect that that's why they are supportive of it. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, I would encourage DEC to speak to that phrase later, I guess, today, to allay our fears about the right to control. My second comment is, it has to do with the lien priority on page 3, lines 16 through 23. Current law has DEC's lien ability to recover for cleanup costs as the first person who can recover. That is, if DEC goes in and cleans up a polluted property, any money paid by the bankruptcy court out of the debtor's assets will go to DEC for their cleanup costs and will reimburse the state. What Section G does is put DEC's lien way back in line. It doesn't put it front. It says, DEC, you get in line with all the other debtors. And being environmentalists, the environmental lobby would consider that to be just plain wrong. I think that the very first priority would be to reimburse the state for its trouble to clean up polluted property. On the other hand, I mean, I can see the arguments put forth, or that would be put forth by certain people who would have other liens that under this bill would come forth first. For instance, say a carpenter lays carpet or fixes up the office building on the polluted site. That has nothing to do with the pollution that DEC's cleaned up. And under current law, and under this bill too, just under this bill, the carpenter could attach a materialman's lien on the property and get paid before anybody else. I can see that point. The little guy should be paid too if he's not causally related to the pollution problem. However, the overriding issue here is cleaning up property and who has to pay. The lobby would like to see DEC get reimbursed for cleaning up polluted properties first. So I guess we'd ask that Section G be either rewritten so that DEC's lien gets a super priority or simply comes first. My third and final comment is probably not answerable today, but one which needs to be thought about. It's probably one which the lobby needs to think about a little bit more too, is it's probably a more philosophical problem than a technical one related to the bill, because we do think that the language in this bill has been terrifically cleaned up. The problem is whether environmentalists can support a bill which absolves banks from liability of this sort. The problem on one hand is there's polluted property out there, and if it gets cleaned up, who should pay? There are three alternatives. There are three alternatives when the debtor or the polluted property is owned by a debtor who is, say, bankrupt. You can get the 470 fund into action, or you can get DEC to clean it up and then try to get the banks to pay, which is what current law probably directs, or you can spread the costs around to the public who have nothing to do originally with that problem. And so somebody's got to pay, and we don't know philosophically yet whether we can support that idea that banks should be taken out of the running, whether it should just be for the 470 fund or the public.
Senator Wright?
Just in response, this it doesn't involve banks. What it does is they lose all of their money and investment, and they pay everything. What it doesn't do, it corrects a problem that was that we erroneously made several years ago, and doesn't impose unlimited liability on them. They have liability. They will lose all of their loan and everything else, and it will go towards solving the problem. But it's no more rational to find somebody liable and then take who has no relationship to the problem. And you take an innocent person, you say, not only you're going to lose your investment, but I'm also going to take your house, everything you own, and it's non-dischargeable in bankruptcy, and we're going to that wasn't what was intended, and that's the part that we're solving is the absolutely unlimited liability because it what it does is prevents a commercial transaction. With regard to the priority, the fact that that there is a lien and it's not dischargeable and has to be dealt with, in all probability raises that to first place, regardless of how things might be structured, because it's something that has to be dealt with, and nobody else will deal with the property until it's done. So, as a practical matter, it does in terms of the property put the lien right up right up front, because nobody can or is willing to do anything with it until that matter is settled.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Maybe that may be true, Senator Rohde, but why not have this bill say that? Why not have it say that DEC has a super priority? In the lobby's mind, I think that we're just unsure of where DEC's lien would fall. Maybe for all practical matters it would come first, but under the current law, it seems to take maybe second or third or fourth fiddle to other liens, including the banks.
Just the real concern is there will be a number of innocent people who have put, particularly, mechanics and workmen who are ended up being shorted by the process. And it makes more sense to follow the law as it is with regard, to first in time is first in right is the. Well, with regard to liens, as you know, and we don't change that. And I understand your position, but it, as a practical matter, it's going to be first anyway. But structured this way, it's not going to prevent a lot of innocent people from being, assuming there's something there to begin with, from being able to have their liens satisfied.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's go to Janice Adair from DEC.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Janice Adair, and I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. As to the last issue that was brought up, DEC's lien and where it would fall, Robert Regis is here from the Attorney General's office and will address that more fully. We don't read the existing statutes as giving DEC a super lien. And we were over there looking again, thinking that perhaps there was something we missed in all of this, but we don't think that's the way the existing law reads. But this Section 2 is somewhat different than what the language we had expected to see in the draft bill. So we will have some suggested changes for that. I also would like to address the lobby's more stuff on this bill than I can really keep track of. The unexercised right to control language and why we put that in there. The existing statute says that an owner or operator doesn't include a person who doesn't participate in the management of a facility, who has indicia of ownership primarily to secure his security interest. What the statute doesn't say is what those things mean. What we have done in this version of the bill is try to give definitions that outline the boundaries of participating in the management, what indicia of ownership would mean, and what security interest would be, so that people are operating with a little bit more knowledge than they have right now. In the case, the United States versus Fleet Factors, which seems to be what brought a lot of this up on the national level, the court suggested that a secured creditor may be liable without being an operator if it participates in the management of a facility to a degree indicating a capacity to influence the corporation's treatment of hazardous waste. While the court held that some level of actual participation by a security holder is required to abrogate the exemption, the court's opinion did not discuss what level of participation would be sufficient to support the inference that a security holder's involvement could influence operational decisions concerning a facility's treatment of hazardous waste. A subsequent decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals confirmed that the mere capacity or unexercised right to control facility operations is insufficient to void the exemption, and held that there must be some actual management of the facility before a secured creditor will fall outside the exemption. The court said what is critical is not what rights the creditor had, but what it did. A creditor cannot have participated in the management if it never exercised its rights. So we simply wanted to make it clear that the capacity to, the ability to influence and the unexercised right to control wasn't enough to abrogate the exemption that we're trying to put in here, or clarify here. Beyond that, I don't have any specific comments other than what I addressed to you last week, but we'd be happy to answer any other questions. And Robert is here also from the AG's office to answer any questions.
Did you have the language set for page number 3? You're talking about the 17 through 23. DEC, the state, is first in line. Did you have language provided for the committee?
To make us first in line?
Yes.
Senator, no, we don't, but we'd be happy to draft that if the committee would be interested in that.
Following on that same subject, we talk about interest there, and lines number 19, this, we talk about interest being perfect. What does that mean to you?
This is one part of the bill that was new to me when it came back from the legislative drafters, and I'm afraid I cannot answer that question.
The attorney's here.
Thank you.
The banister's here if you want to answer.
Further questions? Senator Frank?
Has the department taken a position on whether the scope of this bill should be limited to financial institutions or whether it should apply to any creditor?
We don't specifically have a position on that right now through the chair. Our preference would be to start with financial institutions and then look more carefully at what the ramifications would be at expanding it. I just don't know that we've had an opportunity to, and how long it might take, to really explore what we might be opening up if we opened up to all creditors. I just can't answer that question without really looking into it a lot further.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's an issue that I've talked with you about. I don't know if I've talked with this bill sponsor previous to today, but I haven't been convinced. I haven't even been, nobody's even put an argument forward to me that would suggest that it would be good to cure the bank's problem, but not good to cure an individual's problem that may have sold a piece of property on contract, that may have made a private loan, maybe loan program that Nana Development sponsors for shareholders. I don't know. There's any number of things. Where a creditor is in exactly the same type of position that a bank or financial institution is in, and I think they deserve that kind of protection as well. I do support this legislation. I think Senator Rohde is correct that it was an oversight in the original bill, spill package. We did not intend this, but I think it would be, frankly, just unfair to provide this type of protection for financial institutions as defined without protecting other creditors. So I'd like an answer to that question.
Okay, well,
because common sense doesn't make it obvious to me that we should make a distinction.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, what we'd like is an opportunity to go back and talk about this and think about what, you know, the upsides and the downsides to that, so that we can make an informed, have an informed position.
Senator, if I just respond, I understand Senator Frank's concern. I think all of us on equity grounds would agree. Unfortunately, it may not be as easy to do as a matter of law. You know, Ms. Dare and I have spent a tremendous amount of time wrestling with the English language and some of the, you know, the various problems, because all of us agree on precisely what we wish to happen, and it is implementing it and dealing with the details that are difficult. And that's the difficulty with trying to extend it to individuals who are privately financed. And there is also a greater risk of what are called straw man transactions occurring that will shield perpetrators from the liability that they rightly deserve. Secondly, in financial institutions, we're talking about those agencies that are the normal engine of commerce, and the privately secured or financed commercial transaction is a rarity. They're one in 10,000, and this is the integral part of the economy. We're primarily dealing with private financing with houses, though not totally, but generally houses and real estate of that nature are the primary vehicles for private security interests.
Mr. Chairman, in response, I think that seller financing is an extremely prevalent method of financing a sale or acquisition of businesses. And in fact, you know, places of business are exactly what banks are financing sometimes. But I'm saying that we certainly don't want to absolve responsibility or create a situation where people can escape responsibility through that. And there may very well be a good reason that we don't want to open it up. But my gut starts from the standpoint of I don't want to provide a right and privilege to a financial institution that I wouldn't to an individual. So I think we need to explore that a little bit more. But because I know that if you can't get financing as a bank and you want to sell your business, you know, if the buyer can't get it, oftentimes they'll take paper on it, you know, take a note on it. That's not uncommon. It might be in conjunction with the bank too, for that matter.
Yeah, a lot of them are three-way.
Sure. So.
Well, I just reiterate that I'm trying to correct a problem that you know, that occurred several years ago in legislation, and that the problem with individuals is you know. It has probably been there before that, and financial individual can do a bankruptcy or in other ways shield assets, have far more because they don't do it on a commercial basis. Banks have assets and unlimited liability essentially stops commerce. So I'm sympathetic with they're differently situated. I'm sympathetic with you in terms of equity, and essentially, as a matter of public policy, what we all agree on is that those people who are not responsible for a problem in this country, you know, shouldn't have to bear the brunt of it. And if there's a way to do it, but it is a complex legal question, and one I wish I had an answer to, because I think you're right. There certainly are you know, occasions where there is an owner carrying paper. I just, if we don't deal with the bill fairly soon, the session nearing the halfway point, I'll have nothing to worry about.
Well, I appreciate that too, and I don't want to.
I wish I had an answer for you, but it is far more complex. It has to be drafted very carefully because there is far more possibility that it could be used as a shield against appropriate liability. The banks are highly regulated institutions, and this language and are easier in that way to deal with.
Senator Rohde, we, I think, created the problem for both private individuals and banks in the same legislation. And none of those of us who considered it expected it to apply to third parties in interest that didn't have any control or even any knowledge of what was going on with the property. I appreciate your bringing it to us with regard to the, you know, the financial institutions think about it first because they're in the business of finding out what potentially could happen to them. It can happen with somebody that has an underground tank buried in their yard in Anchorage because they went to gas 20 years ago that is still full of diesel fuel just as easily, and it can be the third person down the line that never knew anything about it that gets it. I think we've got to deal with both of them, and I would ask that DEC come back to us with a proposal that lays out the criteria in which third-party interests, regardless what they are, should not be held liable under this standard.
Mr. Chairman, I'd urge us to do it in a separate bill. Quite frankly, you know, what the House response will, you know, will be on this, it hasn't been an easy issue. And the more baggage that's tied on this particular camel, I'm afraid, reduces its chance of getting across the desert. And also, it takes time.
I'm afraid the individual who sold her house when she retired 10 years ago and has been sold two times since then, and who is now, you know, living on a very limited fixed income, when she's presented with the bill, has no camel to ride at all. And I think
we want to stay with the camel analogy.
Sorry, I brought it up.
I think if we make a camel train out of it, then we can carry more baggage.
That's a good idea. And the committee will then surely draft bill number two on this issue, and I'll be happy to work with the committee.
Senator, I would apologize for not getting this in this draft that's before us, but I think we do have to go back to DEC, and we need your help to come up with something that provides the criteria under which a third-party interest should not be liable. Senator Frank.
Let's take an example of a creditor. Let's say you have a gas station, and you have in the 20 years that you've owned it, the gas station ground has been major polluted, okay? Now, you sell it to the next person, and you sell it not through an institution, but, or not, you know, you take a note back. Wouldn't that original party that created the pollution individual, wouldn't they still be liable under this or other law, under other law? They
yes.
would. They would. So they would. We wouldn't be absolving them of responsibility. My concern is the exact opposite of a situation where you have a piece of ground, you sell it to somebody on contract, they put a gas station on the ground, and it becomes polluted. The bank or the gas station goes bankrupt, or before it goes bankrupt, the pollution's uncovered and. State comes in, spends $5 million to clean it up, and the person that sold the ground in the first place to the person that put a gas station on it gets a bill for $5 million. That's what I don't want to happen. And I don't know why you couldn't just use the word creditor. I don't know what problems would be involved if you used the word creditor as opposed to describing financial institution here. Yeah, that ties into another law, I assume.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, I apologize. I was looking for something and I think might have missed part of what you said. The original landowner sells it, somebody puts a gas station on it, and DEC, in using its charm, comes back against the owner of the property, the original property owner.
Mm-hmm.
I think that under the existing statute, they'd be an innocent third party, and the existing statute already exempts them. I don't think that's a
problem. I didn't explain the situation very well. What I should have said was this.
They had a gas station on it.
No, they didn't have a gas station on it. They did not. They didn't have anything on it. But what they did was the next person put a gas station on it. And the original party, not realizing that the property was polluted, they didn't get their money. The gas station person didn't pay them. So they foreclosed on it to recover their ownership position in the land and recover. Well, after the foreclosure was complete, they found, they did an environmental assessment, and they found out that the thing was, a $5 million problem. They were the owner of record, and they get a $5 million bill from DEC. That is what the banks have told me is the problem that they're trying to fix. Now, I say the same problem can occur in the private sector. It's all private sector, but, in a private party transaction between two individuals and not involving a financial institution.
May I ask a question, please?
Just please do.
If I can step out of my role representing DEC and just ask a question, who should pay? Should the state pay? If the person who put the gas station on there, just so that we understand a little bit better where you want to go, the person who put the gas station on that property obviously doesn't have any money. That's why the original landowner took the property back. Who should pay?
Okay, I'll step out on that one. I believe that the society through state government should pay before that innocent third party should have to pay.
Mr. Chairman? If I could interject, Senator. And I was going to make the same point that Dennis just made, and that is certainly if you were to just in the front of the bill put creditor along with the banks, what would happen then is the people that have the house would lose all of their interest in that property, which is what the bank loses. They lose all their loan, everything. It's just that you don't have extended liability to the entire assets of the bank, because then they won't make loans, and that has a negative commerce effect. We didn't intend that. That's what we're trying to correct. So if a logical extension of what you're trying to do is they still lose all their money, the house, the property, everything. The bank loses the same thing, but they wouldn't have any liability
beyond
that. They're
liable to the extent of their investment and not to the extent of their net worth.
Yes.
And that's a significant, that's the halfway step that gets back. And
that's what the banks ask for, in layman's terms, and I think that's what we've all been trying to achieve.
And if you wish to go further than that for private individuals, it becomes more difficult. And from your examples you wish to go a great deal further than that, and I don't know how to dovetail
it in the
bill.
I'm not saying that we need to go a great deal further than that. I'm not saying that we should, go as far as to say, well, their investment should be protected, because then you got to figure out what the fair market value was and all those kinds of problems. I'm just saying that they shouldn't get a bill from the government for the entire expense of the cleanup above and beyond the value of their original investment. And that's the same thing that the banks were scared of, and rightfully so.
Yeah, the examples that you gave were different, though. They were.
Sometimes we use examples when we're trying to make our points.
Well, stick with the camels.
My same point is the same. Yeah, I mean, the guy would lose his investment if we put him in under this scenario. He wouldn't be given a $5 million bill when he sold the land for $40,000. He's going to lose his $40,000, but he isn't going to be stuck with a $5 million bill. That's, that would be my objective. Put him on at least an equal footing with the banks.
There. I don't know if we changed that in the spill. I don't think that we created that liability in the spill bill.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you guys are wrestling around with is infamous House Bill 68, which we'd be good, but we'd be not that good to go back and rewrite that this session. That bill went through this body. It took 2 years. There were many, many, many hearings. It was House Bill 68 that tried to clarify the exemption for bankers. I have all of the committee printouts in this file for minutes, if anyone's interested, where we talked about airplanes and fuel going upriver, and the plane that crashes in the mountain, should the guy have to go out there and be strictly liable for the contamination for the fuel of his airplane? And all of those things were debated ad nauseum in this committee and others that heard House Bill 68. The thing that the legislature did is it took a standard in federal law that applies to hazardous substances, and it said it'll apply to hazardous substances and petroleum products in the state of Alaska. So you took a federal standard and you applied it to the state of Alaska and you expanded what substances it would apply to. It's based on the theory that the polluter pays, not the state, not society, not an innocent third party, but the person who caused the pollution. And if the person who caused the pollution doesn't have any money, then the state cleans it up and we attach a lien on everything this poor fellow may have or may hope to have, with the theory being that if a person who is in the business of handling a hazardous substance, either as a transporter, a generator, or a user, knows that ultimately they're going to be responsible for anything that falls out into the atmosphere, the land, or the water, that they'll be more careful with how they handle this. Now, I am not here to pass judgment on that as a theory, but that is what's behind it. And if you are going to start going back and re-looking at the idea that the polluter pays and how this whole scenario is set up, I think that's a bigger job than we can handle.
Nobody, I don't think, on this committee is challenging that the polluter pays. But we have a statute that assumes that the owner is the polluter if there's nobody else that happens to be there, or the security interest holder is the polluter. And that may not be the case. And that's the area that we're trying to deal with. Not that the polluter should pay the bill. Obviously, the polluter should pay the bill. But there are innocent third parties who happen to be owners or who happen to be security interest holders. And we're just trying to reach that. Senator Frank.
Thank you. Maybe there's a simple answer to it. Maybe Terry Bannister can tell us. But if what we did back when we passed the spill package was to say that financial institutions are liable, not owners, because an owner may be a financial institution or it may be a private party individual. If they said a financial institution is liable, then fine, we can limit our scope to financial institutions because that's all we drug in the first place. But I don't know that if that's all we drug in. I don't know if the individual that becomes an owner through a foreclosure action in a private seller financing situation, if we drug that person in unwittingly back when we drug the financial institutions into this thing, then I think we should drag them back out. But if we didn't drag them in, then we can pass this bill out without amendment and go forward. Maybe Terry can answer that question.
I'm not that familiar with the other provisions of the bill aside of the chapter of those sections aside from what's in this bill. All I do know, I would have to defer to someone else who's worked in this area. I do know it's a very complicated situation and it's not easy to say who's not liable and who isn't, because there are all kinds of qualifications every time you determine it.
Mr. Chairman, this is Robert Regis with the AG's office, who is very familiar with Title 46.
Right now, the House or Senate Bill 154 would limit the exemption that exists in the law more than the current exemption. The current exemption says that owner and operator, the term owner and operator, does not include a person who, without participating in the management of a vessel or facility, holds indicia of ownership primarily to protect that person's security interest in the vessel or facility. So we start out, and this is a jurisdictional matter, we start out by saying jurisdictionally we have subject matter jurisdiction over this group of people. This group of people includes owners and operators, amongst others. Then we say certain people aren't going to be owners and operators within the meaning of this law because we don't want to hold them liable. And those are any people who hold indicia of ownership primarily to protect security interest. So I think Senator Frank is correct by saying, by looking only at financial institutions, you have in fact carved out a subset of the people who are otherwise entitled to this exemption. Maybe you want to do that. I wasn't in the process of the early parts of this bill, but it seems to me that it's readily corrected. In your bill, you do not make major changes to this jurisdictional element. If I could take the bill for a moment, I see it as two key parts. Section 1 deals with this jurisdictional element, whereas Section 2, the lien provision, simply limits one of my enforcement tools. With respect to Section 1 and the jurisdictional element, all you're doing there is giving breadth, giving scope to the terms that are used in this definition, this 4603826, subsection 8B, this exemption. So where it said simply before that these people are exempt, people who, without participating in the management of a vessel, well, we define then what participating in the management of a vessel means. We simply looked at what have the courts said it means and taken those elements and applied them. The exemption applies to people who hold a security interest or indicia of ownership, primarily to protect the security interest. Those terms, again, are defined. You're not making substantial changes to that exemption by merely defining those terms if you simply define them within the scope of a person. So, for instance, page 1, line 14, you now say, indicia of ownership means, comma, with regard to financial institutions, comma, evidence of. We'll delete that reference, and so on and so forth throughout. So it's simply indicia of ownership means evidence of interests held in real or personal property as security interests, so on and so forth. You would delete references to financial institution on page 2, lines 1, 7, 8, 12, 30, 31, places like that, and just bring it back to an exemption that applies to any person who happens to hold the property in this manner. I think that's what it applies to now, is any person, quite frankly.
What's wrong with it?
Well, the only thing that I understand is wrong with it is that some courts have taken a fairly limited view of what these terms mean, this holding indicia of ownership primarily to protect your security interest. So what this bill does is give a fairly broad reading to those terms. In one place, it very clearly expands on what the judiciary has said, and that is with respect to indicia of ownership, including the holding of full title. No court has said that holding full title is included in mere indicia of ownership. Once you've foreclosed, you're an owner. So this bill certainly goes beyond any judicial concepts of indicia of ownership rendered so far. And I understand that's the intent. That would solve the problem of a lot of the bankers and as well as the other creditors.
Frank?
Thank you. I got a couple of questions there. Are you... Maybe we can best understand this by use of examples. The bank that forecloses on a defaulting loan and takes ownership, subsequently finds out that there is a pollution problem that's going to take multi-million dollars to solve it. I thought that's what we were trying to solve. Okay, now, what did you say with regards to the judiciary's...
In that context, that is a problem now, and I understand that is the problem you are trying to resolve. The bank would have already foreclosed,
right. And
therefore the bank was an owner.
Right.
They did not merely have indicia of ownership.
Right.
They had ownership.
Right.
Now what you're saying in this bill is indicia of ownership can mean holding full title.
Right.
Under certain circumstances. So yes, you're going beyond the existing law with that regard.
Okay.
But my reference to where you are would not be going beyond existing law was with respect to deletion of references to financial institution and making this exemption apply to all persons,
right.
Because existing law applies it to all persons.
So if we if we take out any reference to financial institutions, then it will broaden it to the scope that's in current law, which is all persons, and just merely change the definition of ownership or issue of ownership. What do you call it?
You would be changing the operative terms in the exemption provision.
Okay.
Or giving, not necessarily changing, some extent you're changing, some extent you're simply giving meaning to.
Mr. Chairman, you wouldn't have to do anything with the full title business, though, because it says full title acquired through foreclosure or some other similar mechanism. So it wouldn't, if you're talking about a person, it wouldn't be a person who holds full title unless that person acquired it through
it
a foreclosure. Right.
They repossessed it
right.
After somebody didn't pay the bill.
Right. So I don't think you'd have to mess with that.
And that's the reason, of course, that we had to deal with the question of expanding an issue of ownership to full title is because you can't get there as a security interest holder, whether you're a private person or a financial institution, if you don't allow for foreclosure, because if you don't allow for foreclosure, then your security interest really isn't worth much.
Right, no doubt about it. In my reading, the definition of, quote, participating in the management of a vessel or facility, end quote, really is no different than currently existing law as it's been developed by the judiciary. Similarly, the definition primarily to protect a security interest, I think that's basically reiterates what I've been hearing the judges say. But indicia of ownership is clearly broader than what it currently is.
Well, what does DEC think if we apply it across the board exactly that way?
If you apply it in Section 1 jurisdictionally, as their lawyer, I don't have a problem with it because, like I say, I think that's what the existing law does. With respect to Section 2, I'd like to speak separately because that's a different issue.
If I could make a suggestion,
Senator,
in that regard, it might, given the format that we have here, we could add just a C that would treat others have. You would have, you know, essentially three classes: banks, trust companies, and then other persons holding a security interest. Language that would that be from the Attorney General's point of view a reasonable way to deal with it? Also,
I'm not sure that it's as inclusive as a person. To say a person holding security interest, there may be some situations where there is a person out there who can qualify for the currently existing exemption and may not fall into your category.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rohde, it may be that you just get rid of 16 and then references to financial institutions, because what we're doing is defining within existing statute this does not include a person who, without participating in the management, so we define participating in the management, indicia of ownership, and security interest. So
a financial institution isn't a person, though.
But it's a corporation would be.
Maybe. They have a distinct, presuming you're talking about federal banks, which almost all are, they have a different status. I'd want to very clearly check that out, because I'm not sure that they fall within that definition.
Okay.
in all cases.
Mr.
That's why I was suggesting the alternative format of an A, B, and C. It would also make it clear exactly what we're dealing with.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rohde, I draw the committee's attention to AS 4603-900, subsection 17, which defines person to mean any individual, public or private corporation, political subdivision, government agency, municipality, industry, co-partnership, association, firm, trust, estate, or any other entity whatsoever.
Earthly or not.
Seems broad enough.
At the risk of switching gears, could I talk about a few other topics, Mr. Chairman?
Lee.
Section 2.
Well, yeah. Section 2, As I said earlier, I see all of the provisions in Section 1 being jurisdictional, whereas Section 2 goes to my ability to impose a lien on property, and that's just one of the many tools that I have available to me to secure funds that have been expended by the department in responding to a release. You may want to simply limit this to financial institutions. I don't know about that. It wouldn't. There's nothing in current law limiting it in any way, shape, or form. It could be a lien against any person. Our primary concern with this current language is just that it needs to be cleaned up a little, in my legal opinion. Right now, it talks about the financial institution's obligation being satisfied with the net gain in fair market value of the property after cleanup. I'm not sure what the net gain is judged against. Let me give you a real-life example that I had in another state when I was in private practice. My client borrows $22 million, buys an old landfill, discovers that he can't do anything with it because it's contaminated after he's paid off $4 million. The bank is in the hole for 18, he's in the hole for 4. The state comes in and cleans it up and restores property, which was essentially worthless, back to its $22 million value. Does the state have a right to the whole $22 million or just the difference between 18 and 22? See what I'm saying? The net gain over what?
After what period of time?
Right. So we would offer something to the effect of that it's really not the financial institution's obligation that's being satisfied by a net gain, but rather the financial institution's liability to the state is limited to the difference if any, in the fair market value of the property before the state's response and the fair market value of the property after conclusion of the state's response.
Senator Adams?
Then who determines the fair market value if the bank has ownership of that piece of property? Do they go out and appraise their own property and then tell the state what is due to them? With that language that we presently read?
Ms. Adair and I discussed that at lunch today. Obviously, it would be in DEC's best interest to have an impartial third-party appraiser.
More litigation.
It seems to me that there's
wasn't
a burden on the state.
To limit the potential damage to the value of the property in the first place. Isn't there a simpler way to do that?
My understanding from comments made earlier today by Senator Rohde was that the banks were willing to sacrifice, if you will, their investment in that particular property. So that in my hypothetical, though the bank had $18 million in that property, DEC could get at that $18 million if, in fact, the cleanup had cost $18 plus.
Well, they could get the property up to whatever its value was.
Fair enough. If that's, in fact, what's intended, we'd like to see that spelled out in the letter of the law.
There's no question that the question isn't in what the maximum liability is. The question is when you're back at some point from the maximum liability, then how do you balance the equities of the parties who are either in ownership or liability? And that the case would be, I suppose, that you wouldn't want the state to clean it up and then not be paid anything. On the other hand, you wouldn't want the state to clean it up for $1 million and then turn around and sell it for 22, realizing a net gain of $21 million on the property. That isn't fair either. That's where the question comes. Not in because we all agree that there is a liability to the extent of financial institution's total investment. Period. They lose everything. It's where you pull back from that figure that it becomes more difficult to craft in this language.
Senator Frank?
Well, in the example that you gave us, let's see now, you said that they paid $22 million for the property. They paid the loan down by 4 or put 4 down in the first place.
So they, quote, had $4 million in equity into it, right? Okay, so then environmental disaster is discovered, and state comes back in, spends how much to clean it up?
In that case, it was more than $22 million.
More than $22 million. Okay. And you, in your theoretical question was, should the original owner get anything?
No, my question was, does the state have access to the full $22 million value of the property,
right,
or something less? My understanding is that they, that the intent of this committee is to give the state access to the full value of the property, the whole $22 million. As this language currently reads, I don't believe it gives us that access clearly. So I'd just like to have it clarified in some way, shape, or form, however we do it, without giving anybody a windfall.
Okay, so I can kind of sense where everybody else is. Is that also your feeling towards the individual? That, you know, if you've sold your house and it's been sold again and there is a spill, you can lose what still owed you on the second on that house, but you can't lose everything else you've got. Is that Al? Steve?
I might be willing to consider a person not.
Well, they're definitely
it's complicated. It's complicated to determine.
They're definitely an unaffiliated party, but if we're trying to make it the same standard we're using with financial institutions, then
keep hitting at it. No, I wouldn't treat them differently in any case.
Okay.
In any case, I would treat the institutions the same as individuals.
Okay. So your question is to whether you give up the value of your equity if you're an innocent third party but happen to be stuck with the ownership. Is that what you're? That's one step further than I think.
Right. I know that's further than the sponsor wants to go, and I wouldn't pursue it at this time.
Okay, because I think that really does get us into it. Senator Adams?
Staying with section number two, we want to discuss also how DEC gets the funds first. And the language that I had still on page number three had security interest in the word be perfect there.
Perfected.
In that particular language. And the language, did you have drafted language that the state DEC gets first call?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, my reading of the current law is somewhat different than the earlier commentator. I filed a couple of these liens, and if I've got a prior super lien, it's news to me and it's news to the banks and everybody else. As far as I know, I just got back in line behind all the other currently existing lien holders. And so DEC had not heretofore intended to create a super lien. We could come up with language for that. There's model language in there's model language in New Jersey, but it wasn't our intent to create a super lien.
My comment was that by the your lien is while it's not a priority lien and you get in line with everybody else, it does other things that we don't with other liens. Yours goes with the land, as they say. So you have to be dealt with, and the problem has to be solved. And it is a weightier problem than many other liens. And that was the point that I would make in that regard. So while they don't have a certain priority, you have an enviable position in terms of enforcing that.
It's true.
The law of the land.
Anything else? Further questions?
Thank you.
We have one more person that's been waiting on the teleconference to address this, I believe. Do we still have Dan Mock for the Bankers Association? Apparently not.
I can hear you now.
Okay, do we still have Dan Mock with the Bankers Association on Senate Bill 154?
This is Dan Mock. To offer testimony on Senate Bill 154.
Go ahead.
I can address a couple of the specific points that Robert Regis was talking about. Question to
place up. Negative.
Are there any questions anybody might have?
Questions by members of the committee? We don't have any questions here. Thank you for your patience at staying on. Okay, what are the wishes of the committee?
SL?
As the well, I think we ought to make the amendments that were suggested by Mr. Regis and then pass it on.
Okay. Why don't we bring it back before us with those amendments?
I'm comfortable in passing it out. If you want to move it, I'm comfortable passing it out.
Yeah.
I think Mr. Regis is clear. Where'd you go?
I'm back here.
Clear. It was quite clear the way he laid it out to us. I didn't think we had any remaining questions to be researched or anything. So
the section two questions, I'm not sure he completed. Oh. But if you can, would you come back to the table and join us? If you.
No. Oh, God, no.
No. Go ahead.
Well, with respect to section two, this was very much an off-the-cuff, so I'd really like to have somebody, you know, check my language. But what I had proposed would be on page 3, line 11, delete the word obligation, insert the word liability. So, delete the word obligation, insert the word liability on line 11. On.
We must be on the old draft.
Janice. We'll work off the two drafts here. You guys switched drafts during lunch or something, I guess, huh?
Fast target, harder to hit.
See if I can cross-reference here. Well, let me try and reread the sentence. How's that? And if that would put it into the record in some way, shape, or form, and or I can bring you a new sentence here in another half hour. At present, the sentence reads as follows. The lien and the financial institution's obligation to the state for the state's costs of response, containment, removal, and remedial action are satisfied by the payment of the net gain, if any, in the fair market value of the property that has resulted directly from the state's response, containment, removal, or remedial action, and that is realized by the financial institution at the time of sale, period. We are proposing, and it gets into an issue that was raised by the last speaker, this last clause I didn't speak to. We are proposing the following sentence. The lien and the financial institution's liability to the state for the state's cost of response, containment, removal, and remedial action is limited to the difference, if any, in the fair market value of the property before the state's response and the fair market value of the property after conclusion of the state's response, comma, to the extent such difference has resulted directly from the state's response, containment, removal, or remedial action, period.
Senator Adams.
Yes, I wonder if perhaps we can put this bill aside and give him half hour. And,
sure, thank you.
And then go on to another bill and then come back to the language when we see it in full, if that's okay with the senator from Anchorage, so we
yes,
have
sir.
It before. It's hard to follow.
I wouldn't want Ms. Regis to do it off the cuff. I'm sure, as any good lawyer, wants to reflect and do some quick bit of research on it.
I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rohde, Mr. Adams, one last topic that we did not speak of, and perhaps I ought to put in my 2 cents worth now, triggered by a comment by the last commentator. This sentence currently concludes with the gain realized by the financial institution at the time of sale. To the best of my knowledge, there's nothing that requires the financial institution to secure fair market value when it forecloses, and I believe that typically they do not. They get back their costs plus a buck. So we're a little bit concerned with this gain realized by the financial institution at the time of sale, and refer, and you will see in the language that I proffer, that we've basically discarded that, and it's tied to fair market value, which is what a ready, willing, and able buyer will pay, not what necessarily what the bank paid itself when it foreclosed.
I think we're probably at the point where we're going to have to bring this bill back. Senator Frank?
Well, that brings up another question. You know, oftentimes you have the foreclosure sale, and then you have the ultimate sale after the foreclosure, you know, where the bank acquires title to the sale in foreclosure and then sells it again. Which time are they talking about here?
My understanding, it's at the foreclosure sale.
Oh. Senator Frank, let's try a shot at this bill.
No! I think let him do it. He sounds like
I think your experience in financial institutions and concern for non-financial institutions uniquely qualifies you to chair a subcommittee on this bill.
I think we can do it in half an hour.
Yeah, I think we should get it. Right, if you could come back with an amendment, we
if
could
you can do it in half hour.
I'll go upstairs and type it now. Thank you.
Okay. Then we can work on it and get it out
of here. All three sections so we can see it. Yeah. It's got to be sitting in front of us to pass. Okay.
There's a lady behind. Somebody has their hand.
We don't need any more testimony. We've had enough rounds of this. Okay. We'll go on to the next bill.
Really brings it.
We will come back to this one if he comes back
afternoon.
With something.
Mm-hmm.
Holy
cow. Which one?
Just so we can have something read right across, can we possibly get Senator Collins' bill out on firearms and school lockers? I mean, that should be a straightforward consideration, I hope. Probably fine.
That's an easy bill.
Okay, do we have anybody signed up to testify on Senate Bill 437? Okay. Let's see. Yeah, we have Gail Horetsky, and she's still here, isn't she?
Yeah.
Okay. And we got Margo.
Yeah,
where'd she go?
She's calling up for pizza now.
Oh, Margo's
Mr.
calling
Casey.
Up. Okay, and Bob Casey is the drafter. Why don't we get the drafter first? And, well, why don't you just stay right here? You can just sit right next to him right there, and we'll get Margo on the other side, and that'll have our
legal triumvirate.
Everybody that said yes, they wanted to testify.
I'm Bob Casey, the legislative counsel who's been involved in drafting this. The first section amends an existing statute that has to do with the crime of misconduct involving weapons in the third degree. That statute already says that it's against the law to knowingly possess firearms in certain locations, and that language may or may not be enough to address keeping firearms in lockers. Certainly someone prosecuted for this crime would argue that the fact that they had the gun in the locker wasn't quite the same thing as knowing possession of it. So the bill makes it clear that someone who keeps a firearm in a locker at a school is violating the statute 1161.220. It works one other change. It expands the list of educational institutions where someone could not keep a gun in a locker to include post-secondary educational institutions, basically schools at the college or university level. Section 2 defines grounds to include lockers and other containers provided by the school on the grounds. This is designed to thwart a possible defense argument that keeping a gun in the student's locker was not quite the same thing as keeping the gun on school grounds, given that students have some kind of expectation of privacy in their lockers. I'm not at all sure that argument would succeed in a court, but it would probably be attempted So this statute says that school grounds, yes, do include lockers provided by the school. Moving to Section 3, it authorizes educational institutions to conduct searches of lockers on their grounds under certain circumstances. The school would have to post in prominent places on its grounds at least 2 weeks ahead of the search that it was asserting its right to search the lockers and that it was going to do so. And the idea here is that this would announce to students that they no longer had an expectation of privacy in those lockers. They would be warned that the search was coming. Someone might say, well, what about the school that wants to conduct searches all the time? The answer would be just keep the notices permanently posted on the school grounds, and that way you always have them posted 2 weeks ahead of time. Section 4 repeats the same search provision, but it makes it applicable to post-secondary educational institutions as well.
I just kind of like to poll the committee. I know that at least Senator Adams, myself, Senator Frank, and Senator Rody all went to post-secondary institutions in the state of Alaska. And I'm wondering if we ever had firearms while we were there.
Are we on teleconference?
I don't think we had any way to testify on this bill.
Yes. But we are on teleconference, and there are people listening.
Yeah. We're still on. We don't have anybody signed up for this legislation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, although that wasn't a very long time ago that you were all in secondary schools here in this state, times have really changed. And I think that I just wanted to read some statistics for you that that guns have become the leading cause of death among teenage boys, black and white. We have some information here. It's in, I think, a Newsweek article, and it says that according to a national survey, almost 3 million crimes occur on or near school campuses every year, 16,000 per school per day, one every 6 seconds. If I may, I'd like to read you a little section here. It says, according to the Federal Centers for Disease Control, one student in five reports to carrying a weapon of some type, and about one student in 20, or 5.3%, reports carrying a gun. The number of young Americans killed by firearms each year more than doubled, kids, even fourth and fifth graders, are arming themselves, and teachers and school officials are running scared. If you look in your backup, there's a report from the Anchorage School District that there were 12 cases in secondary schools reported where kids had guns. And in grade school, there were 3. And if you read the backup from the Anchorage, Fairbanks, North Star Bureau, that's really telling. And I'm going to read a letter to you that was in today's paper. I think it's in your backup, but it's from a student in service. And it's interesting because that's when I became aware that kids were afraid of being in school. I taught a civics class at Service High School this year, and when I was through, it was the lunch break, and I was hanging around the halls with the kids, and I was surprised to have students telling me that they were afraid of being in school, that there were kids in school who had weapons and they didn't feel safe. And I just would caution you to read this letter in the editor today from a Service High School student, and he's talking about the subject that we're discussing today. And it's really kind of scary. And all that this bill does is really to reiterate and facilitate the school administration's ability to deal with weapons in school.
Senator Frank?
What do they do now if they find somebody with a gun in their locker?
Well, usually they suspend the child.
And
that's my understanding.
So what would happen under this case?
Well, the punishment would remain the same. What the bill does is it puts in statute some of the policies and further clarifies the policies that currently exist, at least in the Anchorage School District. And it makes it clear that a locker is not considered private property, so that they can search the locker if they feel it's necessary. My understanding is, and I'm not an attorney, my understanding is right now, like in Anchorage, they can search a locker for a specific item for a specific charge. If a child says that Joe Smith has a gun, and the school can now look at the locker for the gun. But the bill would, if a child came and said, there's some students who brought some guns to school and they're going to start shooting, that with the bill, the school would have the ability to do the locker search to find the guns. And that's the difference, as I understand it, with the, what the bill does. Is that correct?
It is true that in drafting this, I tried to make it work in a way where schools didn't have to treat each instance of a possible gun in a locker as being a unique circumstance that required going back to an attorney for another legal review of whether locker 228 could be looked at. It was designed to set up a situation where lockers could just always be looked at.
My comment on the educational institutions, I guess, it's just as a graduate of AMU, I know at that time many students hunted, and that was their only place they had, and there were firearms in lockers, rifles. And I understand the same was the case at University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and I expect, Sheldon Jackson or anywhere else. Senator Frank?
Yeah, I guess, I haven't read this thoroughly, but I guess if you have a dorm room, would that be considered within the grounds of or parking lot or even adjacent to your private school, elementary school, or post-secondary? So if you've got a hunting rifle, you couldn't keep it. Frankly, I mean, I don't know, this gets into another question I suspect there's quite a few, if I don't know, maybe not quite a few, but I assume there's some women that carry a gun in their room, in their purse. I don't know if that's legal, but I assume it's legal to carry a gun in your dorm room. I don't know. Is it? We've had rapes and killings in dorm rooms, so I don't know.
And that's the only section I had.
We did discuss this with Randy Wedman, and she said they can't keep guns in their rooms.
They can't.
This wouldn't impact that. Just be
legally
anyway.
Could I ask Gail about the search provision that is one that I had questioned about as a matter of law and reasons to understand the court has been fairly strict, of course, in what it allows of searching. Do you have any thoughts on the language in the bill vis-a-vis our court's decisions in this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rohde, I'm very glad you asked me that question.
Yeah, she has a pile of amendments, I think.
I have a packet of amendments here. I have discussed them briefly with the sponsor, and they're offered in the spirit of suggestion to the committee for your consideration for whatever you deem appropriate. Mr. Chairman, there were two concerns that were raised with me when I looked at the bill. One was the language on sections 3 and 4, specifically lines 21 and 22 in section 3, where it talks about the administrative officer to determine compliance. That really wasn't clear to me, and so I made a suggestion there in the paper that's being passed around that there'd be a period just after chief administrative officer and then down further, same thing on line 31. But then the new language would be introduced, or I'm suggesting to you, Mr. Chairman, you may want to consider it to be introduced, and that's a new subsection C in both section 3 and section 4, which would basically say nothing in this section affects the ability of a peace officer, chief administrative officer, or other appropriate person acting in compliance with local, state, or federal law to search the locker or other container provided in a public or private school by the school district. And that same language is then mirrored in section 4. Mr. Chairman, the reason for this suggestion is that school lockers can be searched now legally. They can certainly be searched by police officers pursuant to warrant or exigent circumstances or emergency situation, whatever might be an exception to the search warrant requirement. They can also, at least in some cases, have been upheld that the school officials can search the locker on something less than probable cause because they're in the position to toward the child of the parents patriae, not of, of the law enforcement agent, so there are different standards applying to them. This is an area of law that is not totally settled, I don't think, but there is a lot of case law on it.
That's what I was referring to, Mr. Chairman, was the, you know, the administrative with less than probable cause. And that's where I think we perhaps run into a little more difficulty.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that issue. In fact, the issue has been analyzed in several cases, and there's a difference between Fourth Amendment protections, which apply to searching a student or the student's day pack or the student's car, versus searching the locker. And the difference is that the locker is the property of the school. And so the school is a co-owner of the locker with the student, and as a co-owner, it can consent to the search itself. There was a time in Alaska when we subscribed to the theory that Fourth Amendment protections were a little unclear or lessened in the school situation because the school was acting in the stead of the parents rather than as law enforcement. And there was a Court of Appeals opinion that used this analysis. No sooner did it do so than a case went to the United States Supreme Court and they came up with a different result saying, no, Fourth Amendment does apply in the school situation. But that's just with respect to searching a student by frisking them down or by searching their day pack. And in that case, you do need a search warrant or the exigent circumstances, some exception to the Fourth Amendment. But when it comes to lockers, what this bill does, I think, is it codifies existing common law that schools can perform these searches. What you have in Alaska that's a little different from some states is our constitutional provision on the right of privacy. And this bill recognizes that and addresses it by requiring the notice being given at least 2 weeks in advance. There is something of an issue of what can school officials do with other than illegal drugs and illegal weapons. Any weapon on a school is an illegal weapon. And that's not addressed specifically in the bill, but the common law, I think, would answer the situation saying that the school should not act on anything except illegal items. And I think that's an analysis the courts will come to. I don't think that it's really necessary to amend the misconduct involving weapons statute to add possesses or keeps a firearm, just because I've looked back at our definition of possesses, and this is an issue that's always of interest to the Department of Law, and currently our definition is means having physical possession or the exercise of dominion or control over property. And I think that a student who has an item in his or her locker is clearly has the exercise of dominion or control over that property. There was a time when we had a weapons offense that required possession on the person, and that clearly meant exactly what it said, and in fact that's been amended since then. So I don't know that there's any harm in the amendment, but I don't think that it's necessary to achieve the intended purpose.
Senator, just to comment, our court has also talked about expectation of privacy and has put great reliance on that, and which is why I've mentioned the whole topic, because I think that is probably that where there will be any rub with the bill, and I bring it up so that because it, my recollection of the practice law in this area is that it isn't quite as, the issue isn't quite as clear as we might like it, and there is an expectation of privacy. We do have a privacy amendment unlike other constitutions, and even though the locker is school property, the student is a lessee, and there is an expectation of privacy. Do you still feel that the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court would uphold the statute the way we have it drafted?
through the chair, I do. It is never a certainty. We never know for sure what a court will do in interpreting, particularly something like the privacy clause. But the analysis that the Court of Appeals made in it was DRC versus State 646 Pacific 2nd 242 Alaska Court of Appeals 1982. That's the case in which the Court of Appeals used the analysis that was overruled subsequently by the United States Supreme Court. But in the course of the opinion, there were many occasions when the court acknowledged the state's particular concern for the well-being of students and the safety factor on school grounds, and that schools have an obligation to try to promote safety. And there were enough indications to me that that the court understands the significance of trying to control weapons, particularly on school grounds, that particularly if notice is provided, such as being offered, or would be required under the bill, that it would pass that privacy concern. There is an issue in my mind. I spoke with Gail Horesky about this, and she considered my mind devious, but I consider it in tune with students. If you make it very clear that they can't keep these items in their locker, are you promoting them to keep them instead in their purses and their day packs? I don't know what you do about that. We just live in troubled times when it seems to be spiraling, and I don't think there is a ready answer.
Outlaw day packs.
Mr. Chairman, I think that someone, obviously, that if someone's bound or determined to commit a crime or a violent act, I mean, they'll figure all kinds of different ways to get around it. So I think that probably, that's going to happen no matter what you do or don't do. But I guess the feeling in my sense is that as many messages as you can give to students that it's not appropriate to bring handguns to school or weapons to school, I think that has a benefit. And I think that even if you had a law that banned day packs, you'd find somebody who'd sneak it into their clothes.